is the history of the SPC. And it's something I've been really keen about for a long time. I guess it gives us a context as to where we are now. And so we have three wonderful, absolutely committed colleagues and friends that are going to share with us the history of the SPC. The three wise monk men will be here, and I would like to introduce Bill Kennedy, Brian Ralph and Chris Bonner as the three wise men. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the invitation this morning. I think the three of us are looking, rather than the history of the council, at the development of the council from what it was early in my memory through to the present. And I think as I go through the material that I'm dealing with, which is the early years, I first attended a principal's council meeting in term 3 of 1976, which is a lot of years ago. Now, as a bit of background, at that stage, the devolved administrative unit beyond the head office was called the area, and I think there were 8 areas in New South Wales, and over the next 20 years and several reorganisations and restructuring, they became 10 regions. Now, the council meeting that I attended that meeting in 1976, term 3, and it was a 3-term year, remember, because I was relieving principal at that point in time. The date is only relevant, A, to prove that I am an old bastard, and two, to see where we've come from. I think you will have some difficulty identifying with what I'm about to say. Now, first of all, the meeting that I attended was a meeting of principals from area little a, including the city of Wollongong and south to Nowra. Now, that was a small part of the total south coast area of those days. There were similar group meetings on the tablelands extending from Mittagong down to Yass, down the Hume Highway, as it were, which is nothing in those days like what it is now. You took your life in your hands dodging trucks in those times. And then there was a smaller group that met quite occasionally in the extreme south coast, taking in some of those. And I'm never able to work out who or what looked after places like Jindabyne, which was a central school, Bombala, and the primary schools along the Snowy River. Now, these meetings were held with the approval of the area director. Most directors encouraged it and supported it, but some didn't. And this pattern occurred throughout the state. The chair of the meeting was almost invariably the senior principal of the area who represented. Whether or not that was the best person to do it or not, there were very few female principals in those days. In my area, there was just one at that time. And there was no agenda put out beforehand. You didn't know quite what was coming up. The only thing you did know, that if you went to the term 3-1, you had to take along your anticipated enrolment and organisation return, because the area secondary inspector would be there, the ASI, and he, in our case, dealt with staffing issues. And it was a chance to explain why you desperately needed that senior English teacher or that whatever. And it was also a time when there was a fair amount of trading went on between principals. I would want a teacher, someone else would want to shed a teacher, and there was a lot of good accommodation work went on. And the ASI then took to Sydney when he had the unders and overs that he couldn't match. Now, in many ways, that was a better one than the central staffing issue that that was around when I finished up working, and that was in 1998, where the group that was doing it had a remarkable capacity of finding round teachers to fit in square holes in schools. I don't know whether that's still the case. Now, the agenda and the discussion at this area meeting that I attended was really dunnies and drains issues. There was no attempt at all at professional development. There was nothing like the discussion presented to you by Trevor Fletcher from area office staff. If area office staff came along, the nearest you got to the real classroom situation was the staffing one. So I used to say to my boss, he'd like to go away for a term a year when I was working with him, and make sure it's third term all the time. At least this is of some value to me. And there was no discussion about any organisation beyond the area. I did learn later on when I became a principal in my own right that there was some in things along. But professional development in those days were organised by the area office, or later on the regional office. When there was still support personnel there, they had some resources to do it. But what was delivered was how you better served the system rather than how you better served your school. So clearly it was a top-down model. The council had little or no influence over key educational issues or matters close to Sharon's heart over there, and ensuring that the department did something for principal welfare. It just didn't exist. You either survived or you took medical retirement. In 1984, this was after I was appointed the principal, I attended the first state meeting that I was ever exposed to, which was the Helston Park Bowling Club out in the west of the city. And it was more of the same from the area meetings we were going to. I could see little use in it for me, a principal in my second year, struggling with the establishment of a new school in Campbelltown. It just wasn't there. Simply wasn't anything there for me. I didn't go to many more of those sorts of meetings. But I did attend the Met Southwest region or area council meetings, where I became aware that there was a thing of a state executive, and it met at head office, sometimes with the DG and other senior personnel. I got to know about it because a person that a lot of you will know, Col Cooksey, used to report on it. And this state executive apparently was a few elected senior executives, I'll come to in a minute, plus a representative of each of the areas or regions who had an interest in it and could get there. People really only paid attention to that report when issues of curriculum, and there were lots of changes going on in those days, examination processes and administrative processes came up, because it was the things they impacted on. But there weren't as many of those. Annual conference, it was a small two-day affair held at Helston Ag College out in the northwest of the city, in the fringe there. Again, it was dunnies and drains issues. But it did hold the election of the state executive. President, vice president, secretary, treasurer. All these people were nominated from the floor of that meeting, and if a ballot was needed, it was a ballot on the voices, and if needed, show of hands if it was a bit close. And I was left wondering how these people ever wondered about whether they really did have a charter from the principals of the state. And because to me it seemed that all of the positions were worked out beforehand, and that they'd open the meeting for nominations for the position of president. As soon as the nomination came through, someone would move, close, nominations would be closed, and there was often no vote. It was ludicrous. It really was ludicrous. To me, and as I learned over time, and a lot of other people, the council, as it existed in those days, suffered from four major weaknesses. It existed on the whim of the Director General, with no agreed basis of operation. It did not, in any means, have a generally representative body for operation, a representative model for operation. There was no attempt to ensure that the whole of the state was represented at some meeting or other. I guess the Hawkesbury conferences might have drawn somewhere between a third or half of the state secondary principals, and yet they made the decisions about the executive at the time. Most principals were not, or at least were only loosely engaged with the council. Most of them were not engaged with the council. It had no ability to exercise significant influence on the decision making that impacted on the quality of public education at the time. Most of the time, if we were learned about it, we were told. Now that's coming through to about 84, 85. But through the 80s and 90s, there were a number of significant events occurred. Through a succession of presidents, and I'm going to name these people because I hold them in very high esteem. Firstly, the late Ruth Redford, whose secretary was Mary Armstrong. Then Mary Armstrong and her secretary was Ron Hurley. And then Ron Hurley, whose secretary was Judy King. These people, all of them, had a burning desire and a burning belief that the council needed to have a clearly articulated structure which would involve all secondary principals in the determination of the operation of policies. They saw that as necessary if the council was ever to exercise real influence in delivering what principals needed rather than what bureaucrats decided we needed. Now the next event that was needed to allow that to happen was that the council needed to achieve a formal documentation which would legitimise its existence and operation within the state education system. And another individual's name comes up here. Jim Harkin, during his term, following on from Ron, and he was very close friends with Ron Hurley, he was able to negotiate with the DG, Ken Boston, a document that gave council this legitimacy. It's still in place. It hasn't been changed since that date. It's passed through a number of DGs. None of them have sought to change it. It's called the Memorandum of Understanding. And the building of council could begin at that point. And over the next few years, and this is the late 80s into the 90s and later, it changed. Now, I think if you think about what your council is now and what I've described to you as what it was in the 70s and 80s, I don't think there's any doubt which one you would prefer to belong to. Thank you.
Okay, well, good morning, everybody, or good afternoon. When I first took up my position on the SPC executive was February 1995, and things were very different even then compared to today. The executive consisted of the president, Ron Hurley, three vice presidents, a secretary, Judy King, a treasurer, an information manager, and two other principals co-opted to the executive, and I was one of those people. There was no executive support whatsoever. Council, as Bill described, was managed by the State Management Committee, which comprised 10 regional presidents or their delegates, and a central schools rep, and the 9 people on the executive. They met once per term, had a discussion with Ken Boston, and all power resided with the regional presidents, although the state executive was increasingly involved with discussions with the DG and at that higher level. As Bill said, council policy, if it wasn't formulated with a bit of a wink and a nod around the State Management Committee meeting, it was decided by an open vote at St George Leagues Club every term three, and of course, being St George, the whole place was dominated by city principals, and you can imagine the level of recognition of rural issues that would have occurred there. There were actually two reference groups in operation, a curriculum reference group and a T&D reference group, and they had actually been in operation since 1993, when the workload on the president and the executive came to the point where they thought we really need to get a voice of all principals so that we can adequately represent people. The other thing, the first council newsletter, I know you get bombarded with newsletters now, but I can tell you that the first council newsletter ever produced was produced in March of 1995 when I came on the exec. It was 8 pages long, and any urgent communication was immediately sent out to principals by those newfangled fax machines. The council membership fee was $100. Okay, so today, while I can tell you a whole pile of interesting things that happened behind closed doors, what I've actually chosen to do is talk about the Futures Project. Only between 1995 and 2005, because obviously the more recent history is far more well known. The reason why I've chosen that is that I think it demonstrates how powerful and influential we were in the past, and how we earned that power and influence, which Bill described. Secondly, I think it demonstrates how powerful we are right now, because of what has happened in the past and how we choose to actually operate today. And thirdly, I think it demonstrates how powerful we could be in the future in terms of our influence on public education. I believe the secret to all this revolves around the idea of us remaining highly respected and extensively consulted by DET, because of what advice we give, how we give that advice, and why we give it. It's very much, I guess, about working with DET, but still maintaining our independence and ability to act freely, providing genuine quality advice with the best interests of public education in mind. And it's about exerting power and influence while still maintaining the high moral ground, which unfortunately there are other players around the place, not to mention anybody who, you know, I would say resort to cheap political stunts and tricks at times to further their own gain. Okay, origins of the Futures Project. Obviously, there were two things that triggered off the Futures Project. The first was the ICP conference of 2005. That was in September. And New South Wales ran it on behalf of ASPA, who was running it on behalf of the ICP. The Dusseldorf Foundation agreed to sponsor the SPC in running the conference, provided we use the conference not only as a professional learning forum, but as a springboard for developing a proactive policy stance on major issues. The second origin was the restructure that Bill talked about. And here you can see... hang on.
Back.
Yep, that one. He's jumping ahead, isn't he? I'll try to play.
This is... Yeah, I'll...
Okay, so here you can see that the structure Bill was talking about was effectively the 10 regional, the area councils or the regional councils, and the very tiny group of reference groups with the State Management Committee or policy residing there. But the next slide will show you what we ended up negotiating with Ken Boston. And you can see there immediately that regions have disappeared. Secondly, that districts are in as the major policy developer. And what actually happened was that we had developed a system where there were structures in all three. But Ken Boston, about 2 weeks before we went to State Assembly in Term 196, said you can all get nicked unless you delete everything to do with regions. Regions are gone, and I will refuse to sign a memorandum of understanding or give you any money whatsoever unless you delete it. So there's the deletion. Of course, in 2003, we did a restructure of the SPC. Regional councils were back in, and that's because, of course, Ken had stepped down a little bit earlier. With the restructure, though, the problem was that up until then we were developing policy on the run, and in fact the restructure of a huge number of reference groups allowed memberships to inform policy, and it became very much more a managed policy thing, with the constitution actually identifying State Assembly as the policy making body on all matters except the constitution. So suddenly we had 40 district reps plus the executive actively creating policy representing their members. So with the Futures Project, what happened was that in terms of developing policy, there was a discussion about how we'd need to do it. Initially there was conversations about developing some policy papers. Those by late 1997, even though we had policy papers, they weren't operating effectively. And in February 98, State Assembly adopted the Futures Project as the major council policy initiative for the next 2 years. Interestingly, it's still going, of course, so there's a fairly long life. By the early 1998, there was a broad project plan and framework in place. Ken Boston had agreed to hand over $50,000 of debt money, because he was so strongly supportive of secondary principals being able to develop a set of agendas that would advance public education. And all recognition to Ken Boston because of what he did. By mid-1998, we had the money. Secondly, Maurice Brunning, who was here earlier as a school ed director, he was appointed as the New South Wales Futures Project Director to try and get the thing up and going. And at annual conference in 1998, we had the first meeting of a group of targeted principals who'd expressed interest in a range of areas. They were brought together to form writing teams. At the same time, Larissa Treskin took over from Jim. So all the previous work had been done through Jim, and then Larissa took over. In the late 98, early 99, you had a development of a green paper, then a white paper, and finally adopted as council policy. And this is the original Futures document. Okay, now, the one thing about this document that was really important, I guess, is that at the time it was printed, more than half of the secondary principals in the state had been on some sort of writing group or working group. Secondly, the debt had supplied directors and other senior people to be on working groups. The minister's office had provided people. Federation and Angelo and people were one of he was actually in my group talking about ethics and whatever. The PNC and also a range of academics. So it came out as a respected document. In terms of support, we've now got the sort of support that was offered. You can see that debt ended up funding over the first 4 years about $100,000. SPC put money in as well. There were four futures principles which debt agreed to deploy for a year. Initially there was only going to be one deployment, then two, then third, and then the fourth. A key team was formed to drive the project forward. It was later renamed the Futures Project Team. And the state executive went to every meeting with this green book and said, this is SPC policy, this is the only thing that we can endorse if you're suggesting a policy change in debt. And all the reference groups would go at that stage. Every reference group had the requirement that they met with their director every term. So in, say, equity programs, you'd arrange something and meet with the director, and you'd go into the thing with the green book and say, the major equity issues raised in this paper are X, what are we going to do about it? So it became a really powerful document. Okay, in terms of players, you've got the lists there, but you know, obviously the presidents over a period of time, Morris, who was here, Col Cooksey, and I couldn't not leave out Ken Boston, because he actually allowed the whole thing to happen. Just quickly flashing through though, the next three, click, click, click. There's a whole pile of project team leaders, and also, keep going please, and there's the four principals who were the futures principals. So let's look at quickly the achievements. Very quickly, in 2000-2001, when Morris was futures principal and then Chris was futures principal, the key focuses were about using technology in teaching and learning and enhancing the image of public ed. So there was a CD produced for every principal. Hot conferences were, there were two hot conferences run, one in each year. There were three online learning projects, which again, when we talk about, you know, how do we influence things, the fact, for example, with SBC UTS project, where seven schools delivered online learning funded through the Futures Project, it actually pushed the rewriting of the debt ICT strategic plan in 2001 and pushed the minister to announce an increase, significant increase in bandwidth in 2003-2004, because we were able to demonstrate from the trials these are the things that were needed. The SPC University of Wollongong project, a series of online learning modules being developed. It ended up debt actually taking over responsibility for that, and the Crossroads units being put online and a range of other things being done. So here we have, I guess, a series of things where people have established projects and in the end debt red face says, okay, we'll take them on. We see your point, they are essential. The other thing about it, in terms of enhancements for public secondary ed, the Secondary Education Task Force was established. Ken Boston headed it, so that's the level at which it operated. And I must say, with a bit of a tongue-in-cheek, it operated for 18 months, very significantly, until I think Ken got distracted. However, in that time, there were two projects, the Schools Frontline Project, 16 schools with up to $15,000 each to enhance their public image and whatever, and the Showcasing Schools Project, which was workshops at annual conference and at other conferences where schools told their story of success in teaching and learning and things like that. So again, it's interesting though that here you have the 789 re-emerges as SQS 3, 4, 5 years later. The other thing that we did though in 2001-2002 is have an evaluation of the Green Book and where we were going, and that actually simply reinforced everything and said, keep the focus on teaching and learning, let's have some sustained, successful projects that really work. So, 2002, here the major focus was on pedagogy and learning, picking up about, let's make teaching and learning the go, but later on, with debt abandoning the existing leadership strategy they had, leadership suddenly took over in the second half of the year. There was an SPC Learning Forum, which even though it's a very simple set of words there, it involved every district in Term 1 district meetings, the state meeting in March, the state training day in March, Term 2 district meetings, annual conference in June, Term 3 district meetings and the state meeting in September. So that was the level of looking at pedagogy. From that, however, you get the effective pedagogy paper, the SPC effective pedagogy paper, which has never been released. And the reason, while you may smile, the reason for it is that the SPC was saying to the debt, where on earth is your bloody pedagogy statement type thing? And they fluffed around, as they possibly are known to do. But the SPC actually said, well, we're going to do one. And so again, workshops, all of this learning forum came back with a refined paper that by term 4 of 2002 was ready for endorsement as the pedagogy statement that secondary schools would adopt across the state. Now, in the middle of that, of course, DET got wind of this, and about May, they suddenly announced that in terms of supporting the 7 to 10 curriculum, they were going to have a reference group, and one of the things that the reference group would oversight was going to be a paper on pedagogy. And so, lo and behold, the quality teaching paper gets written and released. Now, the significance of that, again, is here's the SPC, creates a pedagogy paper, keeps going to the DET saying, where's your pedagogy paper, where's your pedagogy paper? DET caves in, delivers it. There was no point in us producing our alternative pedagogy paper because it was almost identical to the DET one, because all of the principals who'd contributed to our paper had already been working with the Queensland stuff. So when the DET paper came through and all the drafts were coming through, we actually opted not to publish ours to avoid confusion between the two papers and say, well, there you go, you've done the job for us, we'll back off. But now you can do the professional learning. So again, action by the SPC at the highest level of moral integrity, I guess, led to really major changes in terms of teaching and learning stuff, quality teaching paper and so on. The other thing is that the leadership development strategy was being rewritten, and I guess personally say that there was a lot of sneaky stuff behind closed doors. The existing strategy, probably two-thirds of it, was effectively formulated by the couple of SPC reps who were there, because they came in with their bloody green book. And obviously a fair bit of discussion behind the scenes about what do we want out of this. And so the strategy that was actually announced at the end of September 2003 ended up being a huge change. In terms of technology, again, we helped write all the specs for that now defunct ISP Web Services project. We kept telling them what had to happen. Lynn Goodwin, I saw today. Where's Lynn? Then, yep. Lynn was a major player in that, and really drove it. And again, hot conference and things. The other stuff. Ken Boston moves to the UK. Jan McClellan takes over. Strong supporter. And in fact, the memorandum of understanding was actually signed by Jan McClellan, not Ken Boston, because Jan was the resources person. And at the end of 2002, or August 2002, Mr. Chris Bonner took over as president and things. So you've got this line of people, sort of the deputy president becomes the president, each one really involved. In 2003, the major focus was on leadership and the role of the principal project. There was a leadership forum, but I guess more than anything, the school leadership development strategy, which is there now, it's not spoken about openly, but very whatever. Things like people don't realise that the actual school leadership capability framework, before they put the bit in the middle, was effectively driven by the SPC. It was an SPC capabilities model that needed to be developed. The targeted principal preparation was written along guidelines delivered by the SPC. The school leadership website was written along guidelines delivered by the SPC. The principal induction program was revamped according to SPC guidelines. Not to say that the other group involved in this was not involved, but they were very much quieter, I suppose, than the noisy people from secondary. Other things, professional learning. It was the SPC, again, with their green book, that ended up pushing the release of all the professional learning money into schools as an election promised by the government. And you've also got the SPC actively developing a professional learning policy and then accidentally helping debt write their policy. And a lot of that policy statement was lots of little red biro marks all over it from SPC. Again, you got the technology stuff, but interestingly, at that stage, the role of the principal began. I haven't gone into that in detail, but again, it was something where role of the principal, there was more and more of this stuff about principals as managers rather than leaders of their schools. And in fact, CB, Chris Bonner, at the June conference in 2003 stood up and said, well, what are we going to bloody well do about this? And so the role of the principal project ended up producing a major paper. The other thing is Jan McClellan got removed as DG in November that year, and there was a major blow because when Andrew Cappy Wood came in, he wasn't encultured, so to speak, with the ways of things. Anyway, very quickly, 2004 and 5, just very briefly, pedagogy conference, the role of the principal project finishes, and this major statement is released, which has now become your principal accountability authority statements for this year or last year, recently renewed. The coaching and mentoring from Greg Dickinson, all of that came through. We actually had the DG and people agreeing to a debt leadership centre at the end of 2004, which would rival the Australian Principals Centre down in Victoria. But a certain tall gentleman here who may have been here earlier today made a decision that he preferred Michael Fullan. And so the leadership centre fell off the agenda. The SPC response, excellence and innovation, came out. The SPC put in a document that thick, and when you read through one size fits all, doesn't fit all, you can almost see the paragraphs in every page. The Futures Project Review ended up writing the Blue Book because we'd produced so much and achieved so much out of the green, we needed to rewrite it to actually remove those things that we were now demanding, accept that they'd happened and now write some new demands. And finally, of course, middle of 2005, you get the sustaining quality schools starting up in a reaction about the level playing field. And again, Chris Bonner stood us all up at the June conference in 2005 and said, well, what are we going to bloody well do? Thank you.
Anyway, it was good to be here. I said that yesterday and I came back, so I must have been telling the truth, although yesterday I had to leave early because come 2 p.m. every afternoon. Oh, sugar. So I'll be really quick. Look, it's actually, I found that really interesting. And I know I knew some of that and the stuff that Bill was talking about because I wasn't the only one here who was part of that. But, you know, it's really interesting. There's a sort of, when you reflect back, where we've been and what we've done, it certainly, I think, in a way, hopefully it equips people to think about where you're going in the future. I hate using that word, in the future. I feel Kevin Rudd invented the future. You know, like Bob Carr invented homework. Remember 1997? We'd never done it before then, you know. I hate these words. But and there are other major players in this room who were involved in these in the late 90s too, and did some fantastic work. But I'd have to say Bill's work and Brian's work in different capacities in the council and the organisation and structure of the council and in the quality of what we produced is just stunning. Just amazing. And people that aren't here at the moment, their work was just a fabulous contribution. In some ways, the changing shape of the SPC has been driven by recurring restructures or recurring knights of the long knives in the DET, hasn't it? Because, you know, as the DET is centralised or regionalised or whatever, you know, because that's where we gain a lot of influence, because we tap into the DET wherever it exists. So we've had to have, in addition to reference groups, either regional or district, whatever. And we've gone through tortuous times in that, haven't we, Warwick? You know, when we have to revise that according to the latest restructure. And the other thing, interesting thing about the last decade or two is that constant restructuring of the DET has actually stripped the organisation of much of its corporate knowledge in head office. And that's been a real problem. But actually, it's been an opportunity. Because if an organisation like DET loses its corporate knowledge, who steps into the vacuum? That's true. I mean, it's a great opportunity because, you know, you look around DET head office and who knows about whatever? And the answer is, well, actually, the principals do. And looking back, I reckon, because my role here is just reflecting, you know, with little preparation, a bit of a ramble. But sometimes I think, you know, the council's role, council's relationships with organisations like DET and the union and the minister's office, it's almost promiscuous to this extent that we flit from bed to bed as an organisation, if I can express it like that. Sort of, this is a generic statement. Institutional statement. But also to sort of cross-fertilise ideas and opportunities and stuff like that. We do a lot of that. And there's been many opportunities when we've had this chance to convey... I was going to say convey positions, but I might convey convey proposals. Oh, it just gets worse. But look, and you know, because it was a funny situation. Someone, we'd be meeting in the DET with, and then someone would sort of wink and nudge and point up towards Governor Macquarie Tower, you know, like take it up there, and we will be behind you if you take it up there. So we'd go to the minister's office and try to beat up the minister on something, and then the minister's minders would fill us in with some dirt about the DET. Go down there, give them a hard time on this sort of thing, and we were constantly, and you know, in a sense, the council has always been used. Has always been used by other organisations like that, but that's a really good thing. Because it's a very measured, we're very measured in the way we respond to that news. And in some occasions, this constantly backwards and forwards again being used there's been some absolutely significant breakthroughs. I mean, I look back, one of them was John Hargrave's work on executive staffing in secondary school. Talk about flitting backwards and forwards. And in a way that council would be the honest broker to help make it happen. And I think there's always a lot of that. Sometimes the messages would be too subtle for my simple mind, but sometimes we've got some breakthroughs. So what has endured is this culture of meaningful consultation with the SPC, and people like Terry Burke and Alan Lachlan knew very well that unless there is serious consultation with the council, policy initiatives would actually fall over, or we're in danger of falling over. In the late 90s, there's quite a few DET policy proposals that went absolutely nowhere. And even the political gut policies from governments over time. I remember I was driving to work one day, and the Premier, Bob Carr, announced that we're going to have a register of mobile phones, student mobile phones. This is to stop bullying in schools. Now, if you wait for 2 weeks, it falls over all by itself. But I couldn't resist giving it a bit of a nudge. But anyway, and people like Cole Cooksey were instrumental in driving, making sure that consultation took place. This actually raises the issue of the independence of the SPC. Look, we really are a very ambiguous organisation. We're actually technically part of the DET, but we also operate independently. And this ambiguity has been really tough for people that come in senior DET positions because they don't understand it. They don't know how it works. And I refer to people like Robin Shree, who came in from TAFE, and another DDG who came in from somewhere else. And what would happen with these new people is that sometimes we'd have a stand-up brawl. I remember a shouting match with Robin Shreve over the phone, and eventually they would see it our way. And really the bottom line to the DET senior officers is that we understand it's a muddy, it's an ambiguous relationship, but you don't like us flitting from bed to bed, not, you know, whatever, not those words, but we could become completely independent if you like, and you'll have another union to deal with. Now, would you like us to tell the minister? Well, you can tell the minister. And that would usually solve the problem. Because then you'd say, oh, you will become independent, and we'll bill you for every hour that principals advise the DET after school hours, and the bill would fall, would go much larger than whatever. But the SPC membership has always wanted to maintain its independence, and that's why the membership fees went up hugely about, what, 6 years, 5 years ago, or whatever. And that was a really good thing. And that's why we have our own welfare person rather than absolutely rely on the comings and goings. I'm still not sure I understand where we're up to with that, but anyway, it's like a lot of things in DET restructuring. By the time you understand it, there it goes. And of course, the senior executive of the council has always walked this a difficult line in the independence of the council. It's always going to be the way. It's the same way with ASPA, the national organisation. When you do sit down with ministers and DGs, look, you do gain, okay, they work on you, I understand that, but you do gain other perspectives as well, and you know that life ain't as simple as it might be on the shop floor of your organisation. But it's really... But I'd have to say that over the years, the previous presidents and so on, and certainly with Jim, that independence is really treasured. And I think it really, really, really works. You know you're really independent when you're roundly criticised by both sides. A DDG who was relatively new to the scene told an international audience that in our various positions we were indistinguishable from the union, whereas a month before, Marilyn Parker told all and sundry that we're simply an extension of the DET. Now, it was good stuff. I really, really appreciated that happening because, as in the words of Kevin Rudd and Julie Gillard, everyone's criticising us, so we must have the balance right. Anyway, and I think also the council is one of the most representative. If you look at all the stakeholder groups, the parents' group and the teachers' unions, we are actually, our leadership is actually, I believe, the most representative of the rank and file. Now, others might challenge that, but I tend to think that, our membership really, really keeps us honest. A few problems we've had over the years. Basically, by about 2001, the money ran out. You could go along with a good idea, that schools frontline project where we got $15,000 for about two dozen schools. You know, it's going to do that today than fly to the moon. The money ran out. I think John Watkins was probably the last state education minister who could lean on some, get some money out of Treasury. Now we know the process is reversed. Treasury comes to the DET to rape and pillage. And arguably, the role of our most recent Director Generals has been to oversight that process. That's notwithstanding their qualities as individuals and so on. Yeah, and ministers have come and gone. Andrew Refshorgi fell short of delivering lots of things, including the Ab Ed review, but he had no money. I mean, there was nothing. He implemented a lot of the things that cost nothing. And then Carmel, of course, fell short because she was just so timid, wouldn't do anything before the 2004 election. Didn't want to be known as the minister who sank the government, you know. So nothing was done. We used to package policy proposals up in the most attractive electoral terms, and you know, I walked away from that. I walked away from from that job, thinking that, you know, you can talk to ministers and you can knock on the doors of DG's offices and ministers especially, but unless that minister can hear the roar of the crowd down there in Farrer Place, unless there's some critical mass of people out there that's going to affect their future that really supports the position you're taking, forget it. And hence, in my last couple of years as president of the council, I started to believe that principals should start pressing political buttons. And I think that's happened really, really effectively. In fact, very, very intelligently, looking at the stuff that Jim and the executive have done with lobbyists, for example, not using lobbyists all the time, but learning from them, engaging them, working out what doors to knock on, all that sort of stuff. That's absolutely critical. The DGs coming and going, I mentioned. You know, there's a lot of talk about the Director General's not coming from schools or an educational background. I think my feeling is people in head office at that level work really hard to try to understand schools, but they can't feel schools. They have no feeling for what it's all about in schools. I think that's the difference. And my worry is that they surround themselves with other people that have no feeling for what schools are all about. And I think that's probably a sad thing. we've had to grapple with other internal organisational things, you know, the president being out of a school. Gee, that was a tough one. In the end, it happened because I was about to fall over. I just couldn't continue. Cut a long story short, I think that's been a good transition. And then look, I look at the executives today, and I look at the people standing for office on the executive. Geez, there's nobody who can point a finger at and saying if they were out of a school for 12 months or 2 years, they'd get out of touch. No way. I mean, they're really, really good. But it was a hard debate to have. But we had to do it. And I think the council's become, over the last 5-6 years, become more centralised. Well, actually, you know, in a sense, it's like a centripetal and a centrifugal organisation, you know, focusing towards the centre and focusing towards the fringe, because the department's like that too. It's a very schizo organisation, isn't it? We deal with that. You deal with that in your working lives. And that's a hard thing to deal with. What have we achieved? Well, the stuff that Brian put up, I mean, it's always up to others to sort of make that judgment. I think you can see the threads. You can see the threads. Ken Boston actually supported, it goes back to how the council's been used, Ken Boston actually supported the Futures Project because he could see this as a way of engaging principals to put pressure on his own organisation. To shake up his own organisation. He was clever. He was a clever political operator, and the last DG, alas, to have that feeling for what public education is. Not that, I mean, you know, many people here would probably have a love-hate relationship with Ken, as we all do. So there's threads. So the Futures Project, the stuff Brian talked about, there were threads running through the organisation over the years that recurred. I've got to confess, some of the stuff that went in submissions to various organisations ended up in a book I wrote two years ago. I'm sure it was acknowledged somewhere to all the other people involved. As far as the future is concerned, look, we in many ways, you deal with the strategic, you deal with the tactical, and you still got to deal with the dunnies and drains. You lose the plot if the last one takes over, and you don't bother to. It's like running a school, isn't it? If you don't deal with the strategic and have that eye on the future, I still think that our success, your success, and the success of public education depends on you having your eye not only on your patch and on state issues, but on the frameworks within which you operate, public and private schools in this country. I talked yesterday about some of that sort of stuff. And this places huge stresses on the SPC, because sometimes it's like principal of a school. If you're too strategic, you lose sight of all the menial things that are still got to be done in your schools. I think, in concluding, I'd like to say one of the things that we've got one thing in common when we retire, we've probably all got to go home by 2 p.m. anyway, really, when you think of it. One of the things that a lot of retired people say is, get up and say, things weren't as good. Well, that's, you just often see that at retirements of principals. It's a bit sad when people say, geez, it was better in whatever, things aren't as good. I look at the way the council works, the way the council runs, and it just gets better and better. I think part of that is the legacy of past achievements, but I think it's got a heck of a lot to do with the quality of the people that you keep throwing up to run the organisation. And all power to you. Thanks, Lilla.